Hello everyone, welcome to the very first episode of the AJSP Editor Podcast. AJSP of course stands for Asian Journal of Social Psychology. My name is Kim Pon Tam, I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the journal. We actually have two more hosts here, so I should just let them introduce themselves. So, Angela.
Thanks, Kevin. So my name is Angela Leung. I'm the co-editor-in-chief of AJSP. Before the podcast, I actually tried to check my computer record to see when I started working for AJSP. So I started working for AJSP in 2014 as an associate editor. And then 3 years ago, I became the co-editor-in-chief. So I was very happy to be able to stay as the co-editor-in-chief for the next 3 years, working with Sammy and Kevin. So very nice meeting you all here.
Yeah, thanks, Angela. And we also have Sammy Khan here.
Yeah, hi, Sammy Khan here. So I'm also a co-editor-in-chief, and I've actually been involved in the journal for quite some time. I used to be associate editor before I started my role as a co-editor-in-chief this time around, but I also used to be assistant editor or managing editor back in 2005, I think from 2005 to 2011. So there's some history here between me and the journal.
Thanks, Sammy. Yeah, I think all three of us have some history of the journal for a long time. Yeah, we've published in the journals. Yeah, I also serve as a associate editor for a journal for several years. And then so at the beginning of this year, I took over this leadership role for the journal. So we three, so I myself, Kim Pon Tam, you may also call me Kevin, and Angela Leung, and also Sammy Khan, we three are the new editorial team for the journal. We three, we also host this epic editor podcast series. As I just said, this is the very first episode of the AJSP Editor Podcast, so I suppose I should introduce what this is about, right? This is a new initiative of the journal. As listeners and readers may know, the journal publishes 4 issues a year. So in this very first year of this initiative, we will try to do 4 episodes, right? Each episode corresponding to 1 issue of the journal. There are 2 objectives we try to achieve with these podcast series. The first thing is that we see this as an opportunity for us to reach out to a wider audience so that we can introduce the publications in the journal to the global psychology or social psychology community. The second thing, we also see these podcast series as a kind of platform for kind of nurturing the next generation of Asian journal social psychologists, right? And to achieve these 2 objectives in each episode, basically, there will be 2 sections. The first section is what we call editor's pick, as the name suggests, right? We, as editors of the journal, we pick 1 or 2 articles that are, we find very interesting, exciting, that we want to share with the listeners and readers here, right? And the second section is called special topic discussion. So every episode, we invite some guests to join us, and together we'll have the discussion on some special topics related to conducting research or publishing papers, examples like good practices in open science, how to manage a cross-cultural research project, how to enhance impact of research, etc. So topics that are not that readily available within the journal or other sources. So hopefully we and also our guest speaker together can provide some sharing of our experiences, provide some insights to listeners and readers. I think this kind of dialogue should be particularly useful for early career researchers and social psychology students. So that's how the podcast series is structured. That's what we want to achieve with this podcast series. Okay, without further ado, let's jump into the very first section of our very first episode of the podcast. Okay, the editor's pick. In the issue we just published in the journal, right, the March issue, we published a special forum on social psychology and COVID-19 pandemic. We published a paper on COVID-19 pandemic, and also we published several regular articles. It's really challenging for us to pick 1 paper to discuss, okay? But Angela made it. Angela nominated a paper, which Sammy and I also like it very much. So I pass the time to Angela. Maybe Angela can kind of introduce or summarize the paper for us.
So the title of the paper is Selfish Power and Unselfish Status in Chinese Work Situations by Jin Li and Liu. So very briefly, the paper's idea is to examine how power and status are related to self-interested behaviors. And the authors further studied perspective taking as a mediator in the relationship. So as you can see in the title actually depicts very clearly the main argument of the paper, which is power is selfish and status is unselfish. So according to the authors, they argue that power is selfish because power makes people more self-centered. So with power, people can become less likely to inhibit their internal traits and desires and behaviors that serve their self-interest. So that's why power may be more selfish. Whereas for status is unselfish because people with high status, they tend to consider other people's feelings and needs more because they want to protect the high status. They don't want to lose the face and others' respect. So in a way, this explains why status is more unselfish. So specifically, the authors predict that power will increase self-interested behaviors through lowering perspective taking. And in contrast, status will decrease self-interested behaviors through promoting perspective taking. So to test the hypothesis, the authors have done two studies. So this is actually also one thing I like about the paper because they use two studies with different methodologies for research triangulation. So study one was a manipulation study that manipulated high versus low levels of power and status. So it's a 2x2 between subjects designed with four conditions. Study two was a measurement study conducted in a real-world settings. So participants were measured the levels of power and status as well as self-interested behaviors. So very briefly, the findings generally support the hypothesis that power is selfish and status is unselfish. And I also find it very interesting that they find interaction between power and status. So this interaction suggests that power is selfish only when individuals also have no status. So having status can actually buffer the selfish effect of power. In contrast, status is unselfish only when individuals also have high power. So in a way, having power can promote the selfless effect of status. So power can facilitate the good thing about having high status. So what I like about this paper is this can actually provide quite robust evidence that power and status are not conceptually overlapping. So it challenges our intuitive perception that power may not be the same. It challenges our intuitive perception that power is the same as status. So having power does not necessarily mean having also high status. And also particularly, I like the interaction pattern. As I just mentioned, power is selfish when people also have low status. And status is unselfish when people also have high power. So basically, this interaction finding suggests that power does not necessarily corrupt, right? So instead, for those people who have high status and well-respected by other people because of their good moral character or other positive traits, having power can actually accentuate their good traits and character and afford them to be more pro-social or less selfish. So in a way, it's the person and not power that determines whether they are more selfish or unselfish behaviors. So power may not be necessarily corrupting people. It's actually the person who is the key to determine whether power can be used in a positive way or a negative way. So that's, I think, one thing that I find very interesting about the study regarding the interaction between power and status. So Sammy, what do you think? What do you like about the paper?
Well, I thought the paper had many strengths, actually. And first and foremost, I think the greatest strength of the paper was that it clearly communicated the relevance of the research topic, particularly, you know, how it may be operating in organizational setting. So it made it easy for readers to imagine scenarios within which leaders have either leaders with power either have low or high status. So I could definitely relate the topic and research findings to experiences that I've had in my own working life. And I think the authors did a very good job at conveying the relevance of the research topic in the introduction, first and foremost. And I thought the design of the research was rigorous in that it consisted of two studies, one experimental and one survey study. And the survey study directly assessed the participants' perceptions of their power and status within their respective workplaces and then examined their relationships of these constructs with self-interested behavior. And the methods and statistics were also very rigorous and reported very clearly and coherently. And many steps were taken to ensure the validity of the results, which included, for example, manipulation checks and checks for common method variants. So those were some of the strengths that I thought the paper had.
Yeah, I think I share Sammy's observations. I like the way that the authors framed the study in terms of its real-world relevance. It started with a question in layman's term, right? Are people in high positions more selfish, right? That sentence already attracts my attention to the paper, right? Mm-hmm. That's a question I think a lot of us have, right, in my mind. Something very relevant to our everyday encounters. I like that this type of writing. I like to see the author's effort in relating what they research with something that is of relevance to normal people, right? And sometimes we receive submissions that are really strong conceptually and methodologically, but the write-up is very dry, very kind of tedious in the sense that, maybe only we social psychologists can understand, right? And that's not ideal. That's fine, but that's not ideal because you enhance the impact of your paper because you want to communicate not only to your peer social psychologists, you also want people outside social psychology to read your paper to get something useful from it. So that's something I would also encourage other authors to try. And another thing I like about the paper, it's, of course, the methodology. It's methodologically very rigorous in terms of the design of study, in terms of measurements, in terms of the analysis, etc. One thing that I really like in, I think it's the second study, is a correlational study. The authors performed a common method bias check, right? That is very important for a purely correlational study, right? You want to make sure the findings are not susceptible to biases, anyway. And one of the many biases that are possible, of course, is the common method bias. So, and that's something empirically you can check, right? You can demonstrate empirically that this bias is there or not, right? So that's something you should try to do and then demonstrate to readers. And that's what the authors did in this paper. That's something I really like. And again, I really encourage authors when they write up their papers, particularly when you're writing up a correlational study, try to do different things to demonstrate the rigor of your study. Try to minimize or reduce different biases that potentially existing in your study, right? Yeah, so that's my views about the strengths of the paper. But one minor suggestion, right, for this paper is something I think is missing, but also encourage other authors to consider, is to report in full details how you determine your sample sites. That's kind of becoming the standard now in publishing psychological papers, right? You have to explain how you determine your sample size. Is it based on previous study, based on your own pilot study, whatever? You have to rely on some effect sizes and then estimate the sample size that you need. So that type of sample size determination information should be reported. Right, so that's a suggestion. So how about you too, Angela and Sammy? Do you see things that you want, improvement or suggestions for the authors?
So one finding that caught my attention is perspective taking as the mediator. So across the two studies, actually there was some inconsistency in whether perspective taking was found to be the mediator. So perspective taking is actually something I recently find very interesting. So one area of research about perspective taking that caught my attention is perspective taking is always thought to be very positive. Right? So it's beneficial to take other people's perspective. It can reduce prejudice or discrimination and so on. But I also noticed that actually perspective taking could have its dark side. So according to a recent research, it showed that in competitive situations particularly, perspective takers can expect their partner to behave unethically. Because after getting into the head of the partner, the counterpart, right? So they actually kind of expect the partner to do something bad in a competitive situation. So it ends up that perspective takers trust their partner less and end up deceiving them more in a competitive scenario. And the researchers explained that perspective taking coupled with a competitive situation can give rise to a self-protection mechanism because you want to protect yourself in this competitive situation. So you actually do more selfish behaviors to protect your self-interest. So I was thinking whether this potential dark side of perspective taking may be able to explain why there is some inconsistency in whether perspective taking is the mediator in the two studies, because sometimes perspective taking could be not beneficial in a competitive situation. So I think one potential area of improvement or actually future direction would be to examine power and status and the mechanism of perspective taking in both competitive and cooperative situations to see whether there is any differential effects of the mediating effect of perspective taking in these two types of situations. So I think this will give us a more nuanced understanding of the relationships among power, status, and perspective taking. Yeah, so that's something I find it very interesting as an area of improvement or actually future direction. So Sammy, do you spot any areas for improvement of the study?
I think it's good practice, particularly when utilizing cross-sectional data to theorize about and test alternative models as well, and to embed that within the manuscript or within the analysis that's presented within the manuscript, so that any kind of feasible or alternative process can be ruled out. And it's often a suggestion that I give authors when I'm serving as associate editor for manuscripts is to rule out alternative explanations, and that's often the case with and that becomes relevant for cross-sectional survey designs. So it's typically not too onerous. It just requires a re-specification of the model and testing it and ruling out perhaps an alternative explanation. And it doesn't need to take up a lot of space within the manuscript. In fact, it can even be footnoted, an alternative model, or it can be, you know, of course, if it's particularly relevant to rule out an alternative model, it can be integrated as a more substantial component within the manuscript. But at least consider alternative explanations. I think that's very important with cross-sectional data.
I agree with Sammy. I think in a year, of course, we receive a lot of submissions that are based on cross-sectional data, right? And I suppose most authors would acknowledge in the limitations section that, okay, so my data is cross-sectional, we can't make strong inference about causality, etc. So that's something basically all authors are able to acknowledge. But I personally think just acknowledging this as a limitation is not enough, right? Authors can do more than just acknowledging this is a limitation, right? They can do what I just mentioned earlier, the common method bias check, or what Sammy just mentioned, right? The testing, specifying different models, test them empirically, and identify whether the proposed model is a better model, etc. That's something you can do even with you have only cross-sectional data, right? So I definitely agree with Sammy's suggestions. Well, not for this specific paper, but generally for submissions that are based on cross-sectional data. I personally have another suggestions, not necessarily improvement, but perhaps a future direction. So, okay, maybe we can talk about future directions. I'm very interested in this distinction between power and status. So in this paper, the authors are interested in how power and status influences leaders' behavior, right? Whether they would become selfish or less selfish. I'm quite interested in seeing how people respond to or behave in response to leaders with power or leaders with status, right? So taking the perspective of employees in organizations or subordinates, how do they respond to the power or status or the lack of so of the leaders in the organization? So that's this distinction between power and status, it has implications for not only the leaders' behaviors, I believe, but also for the other people, subordinates' behavior. So that's something quite interesting to explore, I guess.
Another potential future direction would be to study this phenomenon cross-culturally, right? So the current paper examines power and status in the Chinese work situation, right? And so it could be very interesting to study it with cross-cultural kind of comparisons. Just as status is a socially ascribed thing, right? It may be more motivationally appealing to people with high status in collectivistic cultures as compared to individualistic cultures. Because in collectivistic cultures, social status could be something that is more prominent in the society. So it may be more motivating for people with high status in collectivistic cultures to behave more pro-socially because they want to protect the face and their social status and the high regard from others. So I think one potential future direction would be to test the model to see whether it can be replicated in a Western culture. Okay, so to have a cross-cultural analysis of the model to see whether there are any different effects in different cultures. So that may be another way for future explorations of the phenomenon.
Yeah, and I agree with Angela. I think the research does pave the way for many interesting research questions. And I think adding to what Angela has just said, perhaps a range of alternative mediators could also be explored other than perspective taking. So, for example, different leadership philosophies, whether that makes a difference. It could be the case that people with high status within organizations also have particular leadership qualities. And another possibility is to explore different value orientations and the extent to which that perhaps mediates or moderates the observed effects.
Yeah, so I think our discussion, I think, reflects very much how the extent to which we like this paper, right? I think it answered the research question very well. It also allows us to ask even more questions, right? Which is always an indicator of a good research, inspiring research. So I really recommend this paper to our readers and listeners. As I mentioned at the very beginning, we published a number of papers, including a special forum on COVID-19 and social psychology in this March issue of the journal. There are many other good things there, right? Nice papers there. And so I really encourage our listeners and readers to go through the published issue, not only these editors pick paper, but the other papers, right? Of course, I would like to draw your attention to the statement from the new editor-in-chief. Okay, of course, that's me. Because it tells a lot about the directions of the journals. There are some editorial changes, editorial policy changes that authors should pay attention to. For example, we are now committed to open science practices. We really want to encourage authors to consider adopting these practices, such as sharing their open data, sharing their research materials, pre-register the study. So we have made some changes to our editorial policies in this regard. So all these things can be found in the editorial statement. So I really encourage you to read that statement as well. So here comes the end of the editor's pick section. The next one is, of course, the special topic discussion. Stay tuned. All right, so here comes the second part of our very first episode of the AJSB Editor podcast. And today, the topic is COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, obviously, it's a very timely topic. We have a very special guest today. So let me introduce our guest, Sylvia Chen. Sylvia is a professor and also Associate Dean of Faculty of Health and Social Sciences at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. And she is also the president-elect of the Asian Association of Social Psychology. And when we were thinking about who to invite for the very first episode, and Sylvia was at the top of mind. And I think Angela Sammy also agreed. The many reasons that we should invite Sylvia to join our first episode. My introduction can go longer and longer because Sylvia has a very prolific career, very accomplished in our field. So I better stop here, let her talk, right? I want to start with a question that actually I plan to ask every guest we have, right? The question, I hope that this question can allow us, so the readers, listeners, to know a little bit more about Sylvia. But love, is that something you can't really find on her CV? Right. So the question I have for Sylvia, very first question, how did you fall in love with social psychology? How did your journey with social psychology begin?
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. My interest in social psychology was derived from my educational background and experiences. I was an English major in my undergraduate studies at Sun Yat-sen University in mainland China. Then I went to the U.S. Studying for a master's degree in counseling psychology at Santa Clara University and worked in California for a few years. Subsequently, I came back to Hong Kong to do my MPhil and PhD in psychology. These experiences in different cultures make me develop an interest in culture. Working with Professor Michael Bond, who was my advisor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and also with Professor Fanny Zheng, I was intrigued by research questions in the fields of personality and social behaviors in cultural context. For example, can theories and models in social psychology be applied to other cultural contexts? Do personality and social behaviors manifest similar patterns in groups socialized into non-Western cultural heritage? That's how I started my social psychology journey.
Thanks, Sylvia, for telling us your story. I think, Angela, did you have a similar experience? Because you have a chance to study abroad, right? I personally don't share the same experience because I never studied abroad. Okay. Angela, of course, you had the experience, I know.
Yeah. So actually my interest and my love in psychology, I think started a little bit early when I was in high school, actually, because when I studied my A-levels, actually my school has offered psychology as a course. So at that time, I took psychology as my A-level subjects, one of my A-level subjects. So I was kind of intrigued by all the new topics I'm introduced to, Freudian psychology, behavioral psychology. So I was given like a foundations or introduction to psychology when I was in high school. And that made me fall in love with psychology and make me decide to major in psychology when I went to University of Hong Kong. And in University of Hong Kong, I was given an opportunity to study abroad in University of Chicago. So that's also another trigger of why I studied psychology as my PhD, because I kind of learned firsthand how culture is so important in our behaviors. So that's why when I studied my PhD, I chose cultural psychology as my specialization. Yeah, so that's kind of also my version of the story, why I like psychology.
Yeah, the experience moving across borders, studying abroad, obviously contribute. I think many of us, but not including myself, because I've never studied abroad, as I just said. But then I think the movement across borders, experience overseas, I think contribute to interest in culture specifically, right? I think that's what Sylvia and also Angela suggested, right?
Yeah.
Now go back to the matter of our interest here today, right? COVID-19 pandemic, in the middle of this pandemic for what? More than a year already. And the differences in terms of how across different regions in terms of how the pandemic is being controlled. And I think many of us will agree that social psychologists should have a role to play in responses to the pandemic, right? So I just want to start with a discussion about how we as social psychologists can contribute to the battle against this pandemic. And maybe not just this pandemic, maybe even future ones, right? It's projected that we will face similar situations again in the future. So Sylvia, I know you have done something about this pandemic. So maybe you can use your work as an example. I know you edited an AASP newsletter last year, right? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that piece of work.
So Dr. Jose Clementine and I invited some authors of the 2004 special issue on SARS. We asked them a few questions. For example, what lessons can we learn from the AASP special issue on SARS, particularly their contribution in that issue that they think are relevant to our current experience with the COVID-19 pandemic? And then do they have any suggestions on how social psychologists can respond to this public health crisis in terms of our research agenda, practice, and service to the community? A number of authors contributed to this piece. For example, Professor Fanny Zheng stated that with COVID-19, psychologists have been more forthcoming in raising concerns and providing resources to mental health reactions to the uncertainty and social isolation related to the pandemic. However, there are additional psychological issues during the pandemic that our profession can contribute through research and evidence-based recommendations, including media literacy in discerning facts versus myth about the pandemic, attitudes towards and compliance on social distancing, home isolation over long duration, racism, discrimination, and aggression towards Asians for the spread of COVID-19, social cohesion in the times of global crisis. Also, Dr. Wei Ning Chan from Singapore suggests that we should look into COVID-19 required activities such as quarantine, lockdown, and social distancing, and identify the psychological factors that facilitate or hinder the compliance to these measures, as they did in their studies on SARS. And there are cultural and institutional factors that may the containment work better in certain countries or cultures, but not in others. Investigation into relevant social cultural factors would be informative and helpful for potential future public health policy. We also had Professor Dana Lee Batley and Anita DeLodges. They said that this is an unprecedented time in many ways, and one positive development has been the unprecedented international scientific collaboration. Scientists and researchers around the world are collaborating on the same topics, such as developing a COVID-19 vaccine or how to make ventilators. Well-studied principles of social psychology, such as reactance or Solomon Asch line task, have direct impact on research to public health messages. Social psychologists can contribute this knowledge by enhancing our understanding of the psychological and public response to health crises and improve public health messages to have the greatest social impact.
Sylvia, you mentioned, you know, so these are these contributors to the newsletter, right? They were authors of articles, right, in the special issue on SARS back in 2004, right?
Yes, actually, Kevin, you also contributed an article. Do you want to talk more about that?
Sure. I still remember you edited that special issue, right? Is it you?
No, me.
It's Fanny, right? Fanny, yeah. And then, I also contributed to that special issue on SARS. It was 2004 already. It was actually my very first publication of my career. Okay. One thing I found is that what I was interested in, the people's perception of the prevalence of different preventive behaviors, like wearing a mask, washing hands, for example, people's perceptions of the prevalence of these behaviors, and also the perception of the motives behind other people's performance of these behaviors. So one thing I found is that people who are practicing those behaviors, they tend to kind of overestimate. No, not really overestimate. We compare people who practice those behaviors and people who do not practice those behaviors. We found that, and then ask them questions how the perception of how prevalent these behaviors were. And we found those who practice the behaviors reported a stronger prevalence than those people who were not practicing the behavior. Right. So in social psychology terms, it's what we call false consensus effect. Right. We consider that human behavior is subject to social inference. I think the message we got from that finding is that people may have biased perception of the prevalence of these preventive behaviors, depending on whether themselves have been doing these behaviors or not. And it's also possible some people who are not practicing the behavior because they thought that the previous action was not that prevalent, right? So the implications from that specific observation was that, no, we need to provide, or professionals or experts need to provide more factual, timely, updated factual information, the prevalence of different types of preventive behavior. So that was the case in the paper in SARS. But I think, I don't know how, to what extent these things apply to COVID-19. I think that many of these preventive behaviors were more widespread, right, during this pandemic than during the SARS pandemic. But that's what I observed in the paper. Well, back to the work that the newsletter that Sylvia just shared with us, where it just nicely summarized for us. I think listeners and readers may know that we just published a special forum on social psychology and COVID-19 pandemic, right, in March in the journal, wherein we have 6 articles from leading social psychologists, leaders in our field, to reflect on how social psychology scholarship is being or will be influenced by the pandemic, and also what social psychologists can and should do to serve humanity during the crisis. I think in some way, the newsletter Sylvia edited and this special forum we just published share similar goals, right? It's kind of like a reflection by social psychologists on the role we can play during the pandemic or in the face of the pandemic. So I just want to ask Sylvia, did you have a chance to read the papers or some of them in the special forum? If so, do you have any observations, or which paper catches your attention? Which paper looks most interesting to you?
It is a great forum, very timely and inspiring. I really appreciate the efforts of the 3 of you as editors of AJSP to invite all these leading social psychologists to share their thoughts and opinions. They provide the useful advice on how social psychologists can contribute to the research on COVID-19 and establish real-world impacts. The authors are experts in different areas and share the insights from different perspectives. They have different focus, like some would elaborate on the topics related to COVID, such as attitudes, persuasion, self-regulation, or behavioral change. Some emphasized the role of culture and the importance of institution, and some focused on methodology, such as developing and using culturally sensitive measures. I find there's one common theme across these articles. All of them emphasize the importance of context, whether it is social context or national culture, or institution or structural conditions. All of them demonstrate what social psychologists have been studying and can contribute to the field. It is very difficult to, you know, pick one of them. I actually like them all. But if I have to answer your question, the paper entitled COVID-19 and Social Psychological Research, A Silver Lining by Joe Lander, Jackton, and colleagues caught my attention most because it talks about silver linings that have emerged from, you know, this global health crisis. When most of us focus on the negative impact of COVID-19 on our lives and work, it points out that the changes brought about by COVID-19 actually raised the awareness of the importance of understanding collective behavior. As they put it, to stop the spread of the virus, we need to change not only individual behavior, but also collective behavior. Specifically, it requires coordinated action at the collective level from the general public, from the society, policymakers, and research collaborators. We should also understand situational and contextual forces and collective level processes that shape human behavior.
Thanks for sharing what you think about the special forum, and I'm very happy that Sylvia, that you like the special forum, right? We did put a lot of effort into editing this special forum, and hopefully the forum will be useful for peers in our field. So we just discussed how social psychologists should respond to the pandemic, right? What we can do as social psychologists in the face of this pandemic. I want to shift the focus of attention to something more empirical. Right? I want to talk about empirical studies about the pandemic, right? Empirical mm-hmm. research about the pandemic. I know Sammy published an article in the last issue of last year, right? In 2020 in a journal. So Sammy, do you have any questions you want to ask Sylvia about empirical research about the pandemic?
Well, the two questions, maybe they're related, maybe they're not. Foremost, what it was that motivated you to conduct the research into public policy effectiveness in containing the pandemic in East Asia, and why the focus on Asia? And also, what you think perhaps are the most important issues relating to pandemic or pandemic behavior that social psychology and social psychologists are particularly equipped to address?
We actually just published a paper on the effects of containment and closure policies on controlling the COVID-19 pandemic in East Asia. I think this theme is in line with Sammy's paper, which talks about the priorities of our research agendas at the times of the COVID-19 pandemic. This paper was in collaboration with Dr. Ben Lam and four past and current presidents of the AASP, James Liu, Hong Suk Choi, Emiko Kashima, and Alan Bernardo. We observed that there have been increasing efforts to pull coronavirus data and control measures from countries and regions to compare the effectiveness of government policies. So we examined whether these strategies could explain East Asia's effective control of the COVID-19 pandemic by analyzing time series data with cross correlations between the stringency index and the number of confirmed cases during the early period of outbreaks. Analyzing such patterns and modeling predictions can help us evaluate interventions at the country level or the society level. We suggest that multidisciplinary empirical research in healthcare and social sciences, personality and social psychology is needed for a clear understanding of how cultural values, social norms, and individual predispositions interact with policy to affect life-changing and life-saving behavioral changes in different societies.
Thanks for that answer. I have one more question. So I think in relation to this podcast, we've come to the conclusion that the Asian Journal of Social Psychology has addressed the issue of pandemics before the COVID-19 pandemic. But as a consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic, it stimulated a lot of social, psychological, empirical research. Since, I suppose, around this time last year, there's been a large wealth of social, psychological research that's been produced. Among all this research, is there a particular study that stands out to you as being particularly interesting or fascinating?
Well, actually, I picked your article as one of the interesting studies that I have read, and you just talked about this. So I can talk about another study I found interesting. So this is a 39-country study linking cultural practices of social relationships to growth curves of confirmed cases and death due to COVID-19. And they found that in the first 30 days of the outbreak, the spread of the virus was faster in societies with higher relational mobility. In societies where people have more freedom and opportunities to form new relationships and terminate existing relationships than the societies where people have interpersonal relationships generally ascribed by social roles and network structures. So I think this is very interesting to identify cultural dimensions that can affect the spread of COVID-19.
I remember I read the paper as well, the paper Sophia just mentioned, which I also found it very fascinating. Actually, I have read quite a number of articles which address a similar question, that is how to explain this geographical or cross-national, cross-cultural, however you name it, the differences in terms of how people respond to the pandemic, and also in terms of how successful these different regions or countries were in containing the pandemic. I remember there was a paper by, it should be Michelle Galvin, right, and her group, on also explaining these differences across regions and focusing on the concept of cultural tightness. Mm-hmm. They found that they used data with the number of cases of COVID-19 and also deaths, number of deaths associated with COVID-19 compared across countries. And they found that basically tighter countries, tighter cultures, right? Countries that are tight, stronger norms, generally were more successful in terms of containing the pandemic. There were fewer number of deaths, fewer number of cases in such countries, right? Mm. So that basically falls on the same line, same direction, right? In fact, at the very beginning, or in the early phase of the pandemic, I think it was the first, no, maybe the first half of the 2020, the one thing that I think that really interested me was these differences across countries in terms of how fast or how slow the pandemic spread, right? I think back then it was in Europe, spread was very, very fast compared to some countries in Asia. And that's the question I had, as an ordinary individual, that's the question I had, why there were such differences across countries, across regions, and how, in terms of how the pandemic is contained. And then I have the privilege as a social psychologist to be able to read these papers, to understand these papers, and I found a lot of interesting ideas in them, including the paper by Sylvia recommended, and also the paper I just mentioned by the group led by Michelle Galvin. Angela, do you have a similar observations, or what interests you most in terms of research findings about the pandemic?
Yeah, so actually I was, before the podcast, I read Sylvia's paper to get some insights. And one thing that catch my attention is the theoretical framework that she used to frame the paper, the framework being biopsychosocial model of behavioral medicine, right? So basically, this model has the biological aspect, psychological aspect, and also the environmental aspect. I think for social psychologists, maybe the biological aspect is less familiar. I suppose probably this refers to, in the context of COVID-19, is about the infection rate, the death rate, and so on. And also maybe the person's immune system, all these related to the biology, right? I think and also environmental aspect, social psychologists have most expertise to contribute to, right? So psychological aspects, we can talk about maybe people's fear of COVID-19, maybe the optimism or pessimism in this situation. For environmental aspect, I think Kevin has mentioned cultural tightness and looseness, and Sylvia mentioned relational mobility of the society, right? So I feel this is a very insightful and productive model to try to have a more comprehensive view of people's behaviors in this COVID-19 pandemic, to have all these bridged together, talking about biology, psychology, as well as environmental issues. So I think this is a very prominent model that social psychologists can work on in order to have more contributions, right, to the pandemic, to the understanding of human behaviors in the pandemic. So the recent research that caught my attention is the cultural tightness looseness research. I think this is a very powerful way to understand why in some societies it seems the containment effort is more successful, probably because the rules and the guidelines are tighter, so people are more likely to follow the regulations. And yeah, this is something that I think would be very interesting. And I think Michelle Gilbert also talked about switching between tightness and looseness, right? Because if you keep on tightening, you may not be able to help people generate creative solutions, right, to the problem. And sometimes you have to bit in order to find out solutions to the problem, such as like vaccinations, right? I think she recently mentioned about for countries with more loosened culture, actually those cultures may be more productive, more successful at finding out solutions such as vaccinations to contain the pandemic. So I think it's a good way to think about it, how to switch back and forth, loosening and tightening in order to get the balance, in order to contain the pandemic. So I think this is one thing I feel very interested about in this current situation.
But that's an interesting point you made, Angela, that I think a lot of government leaders are having headache in terms of how do you make this balance between tightening without losing their political power, right? As social psychologists, we have a lot of things we can contribute. But obviously, we need research that integrates different insights from different disciplines, right? We are particularly equipped with the understanding of social psychological processes, the way that people relate to others, our perceptions, our cognitive processes, etc. But that's just part of the story, obviously. So we have had a very fruitful discussion about the pandemic and social psychology today. I think before we end, I have one very last question for Sylvia about how we move forward, right? Well, we hope that this podcast series will help early career researchers, students, but in particular. So from your experience of the pandemic and also of the social psychological literature about the pandemic, what would be your advice for early career researchers and social psychology students? Mm-hmm. What is the message you would tell them? It could be about their research priorities, approaches, etc. What would be the message you give them, given our experience of the pandemic?
We can see that the pandemic has inspired scholars in different fields to do interdisciplinary research. In social psychology, we now pay more attention to linking infectious diseases and social behaviors and to identify psychological factors contributing to health-related behaviors. In particular, the effects of cultural dimensions, as we just discussed, have become more salient. One example is that in recent years, we have witnessed a trend of increasing individualism around the world, even in collectivistic cultures such as Japan and China. But the pandemic has raised the awareness or the value and importance of collectivism as people in collectivistic cultures tend to follow the social norms and control measures more closely. So we're not saying collectivism is better than individualism, but rather cultural values function differently in different contexts. It is our job as social psychologists to study which value works better in what context and how it works better so that we can make good use of the cultural resources we have. I think that's one of the, thoughts that I have for now.
So thanks a lot for sharing this advice with us and also with our listeners and readers. I totally agree with you, the importance of considering the role of culture and consider the dynamics of the influence of culture. Is not to say that either individualism collection is always more effective or not. It's how culture responds to different situations of the society, right? I think that I totally agree with you. So that also comes to the end of our discussion on this special topic about COVID-19 pandemic. We were so happy to have Sylvia joining us today. We've learned a lot from the paper you published and the newsletter you edited, and of course, from your sharing in this discussion today. Thanks a lot, Sylvia.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for having me. It is a great pleasure discussing all these different interesting issues with the three of you.
So here also comes to the end of the first episode of our podcast series. Please stay tuned to us. There will be three more episodes in a year. I really look forward to seeing you again in the next episode. In the meantime, stay healthy and stay safe. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.